Hello, you're listening to the Brainy Speech Therapist podcast. We're your hosts, Helen McLean and Jan McIntosh Brown. Here, we aim to look at all aspects of brain injury, from the research to the rehabilitation, and always through the lens of speech and language therapy.
Welcome to episode 5 of the Brainy Speech Therapist podcast. I'm Jan.
And this is Helen. Thank you for joining us for this episode. We really enjoyed speaking to our guest this week. It was the first time either of us had spoken to her directly, and we're so grateful to her for giving us some of her time.
And yeah, I first heard about Jane Johnson through the Bulletin some time ago when I read about that she'd set up the Positive Behaviour Sen, which is a Facebook group primarily, but Jane also provides lots of resources and mentoring. So we really hope you enjoy listening to Jane. She will introduce herself after this short message.
The opinions and views expressed in this podcast are of the individual and should not be considered professional advice. If you have a brain injury, suspect you have a brain injury, or think someone you know has a brain injury, please seek dedicated professional advice.
Tonight we're going to talk about positive behaviour support, or PBS, which I hear a lot of people talking about, but I don't really know much about it. What about you, Helen?
Yeah, I'm very much in a similar boat to yourself, Jan. I think until you suggested the topic, it wasn't a phrase that I was familiar with, but having done a little bit of reading, I'm thinking it might be something that will be really interesting for our listeners to hear about.
Yeah, definitely. So we do have a fantastic guest here to help us tonight, Jane Johnson. Jane and Helen and I have not spoken before. So Jane, I have been following your Facebook group and looking at some of the resources that you're suggesting. But how about you tell us a little bit more about you?
Hi, well, thank you very much for inviting me on today, and lovely to virtually meet you. So yes, I've been a speech and language therapist now for almost 25 years, and I've actually always worked in the area of learning disability, from both preschool services, school age, specialist colleges and adult learning disability teams. And I guess as a speech and language therapist, in lots of the settings I've worked in, whether it's in the community or in a school, often the people that get referred to us, or the people that staff come and ask us about most frequently, are those people for whom they're finding it difficult to manage some aspect of their behaviour. And often as speech and language therapists, I think we find ourselves as one of the kind of visiting professionals who people see most frequently. And so quite often the questions come to us and we try and help with something that feels like sensible advice, but often I've been there and I've really felt quite helpless to know what to sort of say. The other situation I think we sometimes find ourselves in as speech and language therapists is when we see practice happening in front of us that we feel quite uncomfortable about, but we're not really sure where to go with that. So I can remember being in a school with a lad of 18 who staff, it's a while ago now, but staff would strap him into his wheelchair when he was being a bit challenging, in inverted commas. And I remember feeling really uncomfortable about it and quite distressed, but not really having the confidence to know what to say or what other solution to suggest. So if I was going to say I didn't think that was the right thing to do, I know the staff would have said, well, what should we do? And I didn't feel like I had answers for that at all.
So that sounds quite similar to a situation that I've experienced, and probably one of many, Jane. We had someone that we were working with who had a visual impairment, so was actually not able to see at all, and he preferred to be in his room. He was just a young guy. However, in our setting, we sort of have a communal lounge, and staff felt that it would be better for him to be up in the lounge. And because he wasn't able to find his way around, he wasn't able to take himself back to his own room. So we were basically, in my opinion, restraining him, because he was wanting to go to his bedroom, but because he couldn't get there by himself, he wasn't able to go. So I totally know what you're saying, Jane.
Yeah, and I think often we find ourselves in these situations and we know there must be a better way, but we're just not, as speech and language therapists, often we're just not confident about what to say. So when I was in my a job about 7 or 8 years ago with a learning disability community team, that was the first time really that I'd worked alongside a practitioner who was a positive behaviour support practitioner. And as I listened to him and watched what he said and did, it just all made such absolute sense. So when I found myself then in a specialist college provision for people with autism, learning disabilities and some behaviours of concern, straight away I knew that actually what we needed to be working on and implementing alongside everything else was a really good positive behaviour support strategy, so that we addressed and supported people in the right way, got the environment right for people so that people didn't need to use their behaviours to tell us that they were distressed or that something wasn't working for them. So that's when I started my own personal journey, really, doing some training with the British Institute of Learning Disabilities and then going on to do a slightly more advanced course in undertaking a functional assessment, which then kind of gave me the skills to sort of almost be the PBS lead as well as a speech and language therapist within that setting. And then things have just sort of continued from there, really.
And I think that sort of supports, you know, our... that communication is behaviour and behaviour is communication.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And, you know, we'll talk maybe in a minute a little bit about some aspects of this kind of capable environment idea. What's a good environment look like that in which behaviours of concern are much less likely to be needed? And when you look at them, communication underpins almost all of them. Mm-hmm. And like you say, behaviours, you know, positive behaviour support understands that, you know, any behaviour we see, it's like a distress flare going up from somebody saying, look, I'm drowning here, I'm not coping, I need some sort of help or support because this isn't working for me, I can't manage this, I can't cope, I can't help you, you know, get my needs across to you. And obviously communication is absolutely core in that, and that's our expertise. And what I found really interesting is that I think doing the training in PBS has really, really enhanced my speech and language therapy practice.
And that's, yeah, that definitely sounds like that's come through there. And, you know, that's great because you've given such a lovely introduction to yourself, Jane, but also kind of answered my kind of first question around giving us a bit of an introduction to PBS. And from my reading, I'd understood that it originated from the kind of learning disability backgrounds and community, and it does seem to maybe be something that's coming through more to perhaps the areas that Jan and I work in terms of brain injury. And I think Jan's got a case study that hopefully we'll talk about shortly. I wonder then if you could maybe kind of explain some of the kind of elements of the framework. I think Jan and I have both watched a couple of webinars by someone in the States called Gary Lavigna. I think that's going to be the end of it. Gary Lavigna. Yeah.
Lavigna.
And he referred to something called a schedule reinforcement. Can you maybe chat through maybe some of how the framework can be used?
Yeah, sure. So you're right. It's in this country, in the States, it's grown up very much through the education system and often in mainstream settings. In this country, it's sort of developed much more through adult learning disability services. But now I now do quite a lot of training in positive behaviour support with BILD, the British Institute of Learning Disabilities, and I deliver that. And it's really interesting that over the last year, I've probably delivered to a unit for patients with dementia. I've delivered to specialist teachers in social, emotional, mental health. I've delivered to adult mental health teams. So the kind of spread of it, if you like, you're absolutely right, because whilst you know, it's started within learning disabilities, actually we all have behaviour. You and I will have times in the day when we do things, we say things, we may behave in certain ways that are less than optimal, and we will at those times be maybe feeling extremely stressed, extremely anxious, beyond our own personal levels of coping. But the difference is that you and I, we have kind of strategies that we're able to employ to manage those. So we might leave a room and kind of go and take some deep breaths, or we may have communication skills to go and talk to someone about it. And that's often what the people we're supporting aren't able to do in the same way. So the behaviours come out in a different way. But we all have these. It's not sort of a them and us thing. People with impairments have behaviours of concern and the rest of us don't. But this is the human experience. We all face times when we're overwhelmed, we can't cope, and it's demonstrated through changes in our behaviour.
And I think that kind of links with the kind of brain injury population who maybe might have some executive function difficulties, might have communication difficulties, and can become very easily overwhelmed and maybe not fully understanding the situation that they're in, and their coping strategies that they might have had pre-injury aren't available to them, or aren't, they're not cognitively able to use them. And so I think I can already see how this PBS framework could be brought in for this group of people.
So for me, really, the framework is two main components to it. So the first is this concept of capable environments. And by that, we mean the kinds of environments which the evidence base has shown, if those things are in place, the likelihood of people needing to use their behaviours is much reduced. In the show notes, I'll add a link for an article about this, a short article. And when we look at the features of a capable environment, we can see that actually they're just kind of good support for people. So it's things like having the right amount of positive social interactions and social attention, having your communication supported, whether that's in a receptive or an expressive way, or understanding the pragmatics, support for participation and meaningful activity. So just having enough stuff going on in your life that's meaningful and enjoyable and to keep you occupied and having a meaning to your day. The provision of consistent and predictable environments. So not living in chaos, but knowing, having a way of knowing what's coming up in the day so you can prepare yourself for it. You know what's happening. You can regulate yourself through those things. Support to establish and maintain relationships with friends and family, because we know they're really protective against needing to use your behaviours. Provision of opportunities for choice. The more we put people in control of their lives and they can say how they want their day to go, or big choices, small choices, the less need there is for people to become distressed or to need to try and tell us in other ways what they need. Encouraging people to be more independent so they can do things for themselves, having good health and care support, so the way your personal care is delivered if you need that, or making sure that all your health needs are met. We know any sudden changes in behaviour quite often can just tell us that there's a change in underlying health that needs being addressed. The provision of acceptable physical environments, and that would include all those sensory elements of the environment and the noise and the busyness and all that kind of thing, which we know people can find difficult. And then the last one is mindful, skilled carers. So people supporting me who understand that behaviours have a reason, that there's a function, there's a message in them. The carers want to understand what that message is and support me to get my needs met. So that's the first kind of area of positive behaviour support, and it's almost like the foundation, really. So quite often, if I'm asked to go and help with a particular situation, whether it's an individual or a whole setting, those elements are the first thing that I would be going through and having a look at. And I think you can see probably from the point of view of sort of communication and speech and language therapy, so many of those are the speech and language therapist's role. So things like encouraging social interactions in an appropriate, meaningful way, supporting communication, being able to make choices, understanding and predicting my environment, knowing what's coming next. Choice, you know, these are all things that absolutely rely on the communication, both between the person at the centre and those that are supporting them, working well. So straight away, you can see if we want environments, whether that's just one family or whether it's a whole hospital ward, whatever it is, that reduce the need for behaviours of concern, communication has to be right at the heart of that. And that's where one of the aspects where we just have, you know, a really, really important role. The second part of the framework really is that that's the kind of holistic universal bit we've talked about. The second bit then is the kind of individual assessment, which is probably what Gary Lavinia was talking about on the webinar that you were listening to. And that's thinking, actually, if let's say we've tried to make the environment as capable as we can, but there are still some behaviours that keep reoccurring. How can we assess and understand what they call the function of that behaviour, the meaning of it, so that we can proactively do things so that that behaviour isn't needed? So a functional assessment will kind of look at a number of things. So we'll first of all look at what we call slow and fast triggers. So they're the things that, if you like, precede the behaviour and almost like make the behaviour happen. Slow triggers are the things that may have happened an hour before, a couple of hours before, last night, day before, those sort of slow burning things that raise someone's anxiety, frustration, and they can be cumulative. And the fast trigger is the thing that happens immediately before the behaviour starts. So that's, if you like, almost like the straw that broke the camel's back. So if you think of you, maybe Jan, today at work, you got really cross and you swore at the computer and you put the phone down on your boss. And maybe the fast trigger was your boss saying, Jan, you need 3 reports to me by the end of the day. Now, if that fast trigger had come after a great morning, lovely breakfast, you're feeling really well, you're doing really well at work, your stress levels are low, your inbox is quite empty, so you haven't got any of those slow triggers in place, the likelihood is that the fast trigger, your boss demanding 3 reports, it may have irritated you a little bit, but it certainly wouldn't have tipped you over into a behaviour of concern. Whereas actually, if you'd already had a migraine that morning, you were late for work, you came in and you just felt overwhelmed by the pile of work on your desk, you've got a headache developing, you haven't had time for breakfast, now you're feeling hangry as well. So you've got all those slow triggers building up. And then the fast trigger happens, your boss rings and asks for those reports. That is now likely to trigger you into a behaviour of concern.
You're reading my mail, Jane. You're reading my mail.
So part of the process is saying, look, what are those slow and fast triggers for this person that reliably predict that the behaviour will happen? And how can we either remove those triggers or help someone cope better with those different things? How can we change the way we ask you to do those 3 reports in a way that makes you feel less anxious when you're asked? Do we need to work on some of the rapport between your manager and you in the way that they build that rapport with you in the first place? So when they need to ask something, you feel less anxious about it. Do we need to work on your headache? Do we need to work on your food? Do we need to work on making sure you're not late, so you're not anxious when you first get there? So the first part really is trying to address all of those individual slow and fast triggers for someone, so the likelihood of the behavior being triggered is much reduced. And then the second thing is looking at, sorry, do you want to say?
I was just going to say, Jane, that, you know, I'm just really loving the way you're kind of structuring this. It's just it's making it seem much more, I know this is an absolutely massive topic, but you're actually making me feel like I think I could understand this. Well, thank you. Keep going.
Yeah.
No, we totally can. And whenever I've taught speech therapists about it, straight away you can just see how it completely aligns with our values base, with the work we do, with, you know, absolutely. And then the second thing really is to think, they call it the maintaining consequences. So what happens after the behaviour? So if we're doing ABC charts, it's the C on the ABC chart. And that looks at what is it that happens after the behaviour, immediately afterwards? What does the person get or gain through using this behaviour? If someone repeats a behaviour, it's obviously getting something for them. So if you were coming to work 10 minutes early and your boss gives you a £100 bonus every time you do that, do you know what? Tomorrow you're going to quite reliably be in work 10 minutes early. If your boss, you're 10 minutes late and your boss takes £100 out of your pay packet, then the chances are you're not going to repeat that again. So if behaviour is repeated, there must be something happening after the behaviour, which what they call reinforces it, encourages it to happen again. And by looking at that, we can think, actually, what is the function of the behaviour? What is the behaviour getting this person? And there are five kind of key functions that often one of these will underpin the behaviour that we're seeing. So the five are, the first one's pain. So using this behaviour relieves some sort of pain that may be physical or emotional. So the classic is someone's banging their head or their jaw because they've got some kind of toothache or headache. The behaviour actually relieves the pain. And so next time the pain comes, the person repeats that kind of behaviour. The second one is to escape some sort of demand. So I'm in a situation that I don't feel able to cope with. It's making me really anxious and I need to get out of it. So that might be a situation where somebody's put in a situation and asked to do something that they simply can't. The demand is too difficult. And so my behavior, maybe I swear, maybe I tip the table, whatever I do, it just allows me to escape that situation. The third one is for some sort of sensory regulation. And we know that for some of the people that we work with, they're either under regulated, under aroused, and so use some certain behaviors to regulate them back up, or they're over stimulated, they're over aroused by the sensory world around them, and actually these behaviors are a way of helping me to escape from some of that. The fourth one is to what they call tangibles, to gain some sort of tangible. So that's either to gain an item. I'm trying to, through my behaviour, I finally get given a cigarette, or I get to go and get food because they give up trying to stop me entering the kitchen. Maybe I get an activity. So I want the TV on. And actually, if I keep screaming and I keep screaming, someone will just switch the TV back on. So you gain something through your behaviour. And the last one is to gain social interaction or attention. So that's actually no one's really listening to me on the ward today. I've tried to put my hand up a couple of times. The nurses have ignored me. Actually, if I start swearing loudly and pacing and starting to look a little bit aggressive, all of a sudden someone comes and sits on my bed and gives me attention and asks me what's wrong. And I get 20 minutes of nice attention that I was craving. So by looking at this side of things and saying what's the message, what's the meaning of this behavior, we can then look and say, actually, can we help support this person or teach this person a better way of getting that message across rather than using this behavior? So if it's attention that someone wants, can we teach them a phrase, a communication, a card to hold up, whatever it is, a gesture, so that they can gain that social interaction, that conversation in a much better way, a less harmful and a more efficient way?
And just on that, do you find that you're always aiming for that behaviour and that skill to be used 100% of the time? Because I thought it was interesting in the webinar with watching Gary's webinar, and he used the example of, say, for example, someone's getting the bus by themselves, and one of his colleagues had said, you know, they want to be able to do it 9 times out of 10 correctly. But he's like, well, what's the point of that? Because what about that 1 time out of 10 where they don't get it right? There's quite big consequences to that. So would you say that you're kind of aiming for 100% all the time?
I think it depends on who you're working with. And I think some of the people that we're working with will be able to learn a skill and internalize that and use that completely independently 100% of the time. There will be some people we support who will always need a gentle prompt, who have 24-hour support, and actually who will always need some sort of support prompt maybe to be able to make that request themselves. So I think it's difficult to give a kind of blanket answer, but the most important thing is that what we're aiming to do is proactive. So many behavior support plans that you see, or strategies, or when we think about things like physical restraint training, they're all about when it goes wrong, do this, when it goes wrong, try and react this way, or use this physical intervention, or clear the room. You know, there are lots of reactive things, and what PBS is trying to do is shift that and say, actually, what we really want to focus on, the majority of the plan, if you like, should be proactive. So it should be looking at how we proactively remove those slow and those fast triggers, how we proactively teach someone a better way of communicating the need, the message that they want to get across, so that they won't need to resort to these behaviours, because the support will meet their needs and they've got those tools to tell us what they need when they need it.
The other interesting thing that Gary was talking about, which really I was like, oh my goodness, why did I never think about this, was the case study he was sharing about the girl that was running away from the playground. Mm-hmm. And the head teacher or the principal was decided that the strategy was call her name and wave a Mars bar at her and she'll come back. And I could hear in my head, even my own thoughts were, well, then you're just rewarding her running away, you know. And so it was then, well, you compensate, or you make sure that the Mars bar in that situation is less reinforcing by giving her Mars bar throughout the day. And I thought, oh my goodness, you know, that seems so simple now you've said that, but it just never crossed my mind.
Yeah, and in a situation like that, you know, it's especially in services for younger people, someone runs away, so you want to give a consequence that needs to be punished. You know, what's the consequence going to be for that behavior? And what PBS is really clear about is that actually punishment or negative consequences or whatever you want to call it really don't have a place within PBS. And I think that's something that a lot of, especially services for young people and schools, find really difficult to get their head around, because we're so conditioned to think someone does something, so you must provide a consequence for that. But actually what PBS is trying to do is say, actually, that girl running across the playground, there's a reason she did that. There's a function for that escape behavior. There's a reason for it. Why don't we find out actually what triggered her, what made her run away, why she feels the need to run away, and why don't we address that rather than coming and actually punishing someone who actually is probably in quite a high level of distress and panic right now. And how unethical is it? You know, Helen, if you were here displaying a behavior of crying and screaming and wailing right now, the last thing I think Jan and I would say to you is, Helen, stop it. Pull yourself together. When you've calmed down, we'll help you. And because you screamed, there's absolutely no way you're going to have a coffee after this recording this evening. You know, we wouldn't do it to each other. We'd straight away, we'd go, Helen, what's wrong? How can we help you? And that's the kind of thing that the kind of attitude that we want to be demonstrating to the people we support who are demonstrating behaviours of concern, however difficult we find the behaviour to manage and deal with. And some of the behaviours really are difficult. They're distressing. They make us really anxious ourselves when we're supporting people. But we want to be saying to somebody who's coming up and punching the wall or banging their head on a table, what helped you? What's gone wrong for you? How can I help you? Not delivering some sort of consequence to it in the hope that somehow that's going to make things better for someone who's already distressed. So there's a kind of real ethical element to that.
And
as
then
well,
there's that concept of least restrictive as well, isn't there?
Yes. So there are a few sort of values that underpin everything we do in PBS, which I think will resonate really, really closely with the stuff that's happening in your environments anyway. So one of them is the least restrictive approach to supporting someone. The evidence shows that the more you increase restrictions around people, the more likely you are to see an increase in behaviours of concern. So the classic is food, isn't it? If food is freely available throughout the day, there tend to be very few behaviours related to food. If the kitchen is locked and actually the dietitian's decided to put you on a special diet, so you're not allowed to eat X, Y and Z, and actually other people control your food choices, you are far more likely when you're hungry or when you really want a coffee or a bar of chocolate to go and start trying to get into the kitchens, hitting the kitchen door, swearing at staff who are getting in the way. You know, the restrictions that we put in place can often be the very trigger that actually triggers the behaviours we're seeing. So not only is it right from a human rights point of view to remove any unnecessary restrictions around people that we wouldn't have to face ourselves as far as is safe to do so, but it also reduces the likelihood that we're going to trigger behaviours. There's also just the kind of whole underpinning sort of Human Rights Act that underpins positive behaviour supports. Everything we do within that should be promoting people's human rights, so rights to liberty, not be discriminated against, privacy, family life, you know, all those things that you and I just take for granted. And sometimes when we go into services and we look at the kind of lives people live, you think, do you know what? It's no wonder that you are showing distressed behaviours. Maybe you've got nothing to do all day. Maybe you have no close contact from anybody who's really meaningful in your life except paid staff. Maybe you're in pain all the time. Maybe people speak to you in a way that's really disrespectful and actually makes you feel really small and really rubbish. Maybe no one gives you any choice in the day about what you're going to eat, do, where, go. Any of that stuff's all just been taken away for you. And when you think about the lived experience of lots of people we support, you think, little wonder. There
and
are
there's
times
so much there
when they
that
display
language therapists can act on and really be part of. And I wondered, when you were talking about kind of the assessment process, I'm imagining that you're quite often involving care staff or nursing staff or whoever, education staff within that, because it does sound quite detailed and it's presumably something that you need to have input from people who know that individual well as you coming from that kind of more expertise PBS point of view as a speech and language therapist.
Yeah, so it has to be done with all the kind of stakeholders. If the person we're talking about can in any way engage in that, and there's been some nice research coming out of the Tizard Centre about using talking mats to support that, then we should involve the person at the centre. That's a really key role for speech and language therapists. You know, maybe talking mats about what makes a good day, what makes a bad day, what behaviours do you have, what things make you kind of, what triggers those behaviours, what helps when you're feeling like this. You know, we can do all sorts of talking mats or kind of suitably graded conversations around those kind of topics. And then it absolutely should involve people who know the person well, whether they're staff or family members, and different professional groups as well, depending on the needs of the person. And sometimes a functional assessment may be a really, really complex piece of work that takes months and is really, really detailed, and that may need to be done by a behaviour analyst. But there are many situations in my experience where actually the behaviour isn't really high risk. It's quite a simple behaviour, and actually the slow and fast triggers, we probably know them ourselves, in which case many different professionals, including speech and language therapists, have done training in doing what they call a brief functional assessment. And that's a training you can do over 2 or 3 days with different providers. And it just gives you the tools to do a very brief assessment. So that would include a kind of structured questionnaire, which just gets to the bottom of the slow and fast triggers and the function, and it's quite straightforward. Any of us with a bit of training can conduct that with the staff group that we're working with. A little bit of structured observation, so we see with our own eyes what's going on, because quite often you spot things that are quite obvious, and you can also see some of the patterns in the behaviour. And then collecting some data from the staff that know that person well. So that may be things like ABC recording charts, or you may give them some slightly more structured things to fill out. And they call that triangulation, when you take those three sources of information, if you like, and you put them together to make that flow chart, if you like, of slow triggers, fast triggers, behaviour, maintaining consequence, what is the function? Once you've laid those out on a piece of paper, then, you know, it's really quite straightforward to then brainstorm actually what things can we now proactively do. If that's what's making this happen, what can we proactively do now to reduce the likelihood, to prevent it happening? So when you actually do one, it sounds terribly complicated, but actually once you have that kind of framework to follow, a lot of it's dead sensible, and it's not rocket science. You know, I did one last week. We went in, the person was never going out. We're like, well, should we try going out for a daily walk then? And then the next thing you know, the behaviours have reduced. So I think sometimes we can think it's a really, really complicated thing. And for some very complex people with very complex underlying issues, it can be. But for a lot of people, it really is quite a straightforward thing to do. And, you know, people in the SEN that we've set up for speech therapists with an interest in PBS, you know, lots of people have or are doing further training and just doing a functional assessment themselves, simple functional assessment themselves, so that we can have the tools, so that then we know what sort of communication behaviours we should be focusing on.
And I think what you were saying at the start about, you know, you go in and you might see a behaviour of concern, and it's all well and good to see that, but then if you're not able to offer an alternative, then it might cause you distress and make you feel anxious to see it. But until you've got the skills and the toolkit to know how to implement a change, as PBS certainly sounds like it does, this sounds like a really lovely, useful, empowering tool for therapists. from lots of backgrounds to you.
Absolutely. How many times, like, have you been asked? I've been asked, "Oh, Jane, could you write a social story because he keeps swiping all the cups off the table? He needs a social story." Why are they swiping the cups? A social story isn't going to stop the behaviour if actually the behaviour is saying, "I need to escape this work placement and get out of here." A social story isn't going to address that. And I think so often for any of us, when people come to us, they're stressed, they're anxious, they want an answer to know, what should I do in this situation? Any of us, it's really easy to just start jumping in with our best guess at a strategy without having really understood the function of the behaviour. Because if the function of the behaviour is escape, I need to get out of this work placement, but we put in a strategy of giving him extra attention and support, we're not going to have met the need. So actually the behaviour will continue. So it really helps us make sure that the strategies we put in place, whether they're communication strategies or wider, actually are addressing the problem, not missing the problem.
So Jane, I heard you mention behaviours of concern. Is that sort of how we talk about behaviour? Because I've heard of it being referred to as challenging behaviour or behaviours that challenge, you know. Can you explain that?
Yeah, sure. So historically, people have used the terms challenging behaviour and behaviours that challenge, and they are still very much the sort of terms used in the literature, if you like. And they arose out of an understanding that the behaviour that we're seeing was a challenge for the environment they were in to manage. So something about the behaviour was difficult to manage. However, I think over time the terminology has taken on kind of quite a negative connotation. So, you know, people start to talk about, "Oh, so and so, he challenged today." And I think the impression it just gives staff or families is of this idea of a rebellious, difficult person trying to come up against authority and trying to make my life difficult today. And that's the kind of idea we get through that sort of talking about people challenging. So certainly Build, the British Institute of Learning Disabilities, and other people, and certainly in workplaces that I've been, I've tried to change the language to something more like a behaviour of concern or an anxious behaviour, to try and just keep kind of sharing this message that this is not a deliberate, difficult behaviour that someone's employing to wind us up. This is somebody who needs our concern right now. They need our help. They are distressed, anxious, beyond their own coping ability, and they need our support. So I think that terminology helps to kind of convey that message a little bit better, because at the heart of this, we're never going to get PBS right if the people who support don't understand that behaviour is a cry for help. It's a message. We need to go and support it and understand it, not punish it and try and eliminate
Thanks,
it.
Jane.
Yeah, and I'm aware that we're perhaps running out of time for this evening, Jane, and thank you so much for giving up your time this evening. What supports or what information is out there for people listening to this if they'd like to know more?
So as Jan said at the beginning, we have a clinical excellence network, which is one of the RCSLT speech and language therapy networks, specifically for speech therapists with an interest in positive behaviour support. We're a group that cover paediatrics, adults, learning disability, autism, mental health, social emotional and mental health paediatric settings, and also some people from acquired brain injury settings now as well. And we're across the whole country. Actually, we've had people join from outside the UK as well. So people are more than welcome to join. We don't expect or anticipate that people will have prior knowledge about PBS at all. And in fact, one of the things we're doing in the SEN this year is I'm going to run two or three training sessions aimed at speech therapists, particularly those who have no background knowledge or training in PBS at all. So we'll be thinking within the SEN during those very short training sessions about what PBS is and our role in it as speech therapists potentially. And then there are a couple of websites, if I could mention, which have really, really good webinars on if people want to watch and find out a little bit more completely free in their own time. So one is the PBS Alliance, and that's hosted through the Build website, and that's lots of different groups of communities of practice who are supporting that promotion of PBS across the country in all areas. And there's lots of webinars there about what is PBS, different elements of it, how does trauma-informed practice fit into PBS, lots of different things you can just look up and watch for free. The other one I really encourage people to look up is the Restraint Reduction Network. So again, that's a network of organisations. You can join it for free. They send you monthly updates, and that's just focusing on how we can reduce the use of all restrictive practices with the aim of restraint-free care for all the people we're talking about, whether they have mental health issues, brain injury, in hospitals, people with learning disabilities, you know, schools and colleges across, you know, across the board. And again, they have some really, really fantastic webinars and resources in there for people who just want to find out a bit more and understand the framework a little bit more.
Great.
I'll also put my, I'll also give you my email address. I'm more than happy if people want to find out a little bit more about sort of the formal training objects, whether that's a really short course or something, you know, more like a master's level. I'm more than happy for people to email me if they've got further questions.
Oh, that's
as well.
Fantastic. And we'll put links and information in the show notes for all of this. Jane, I have to say, your enthusiasm for the subject, your skill, even just talking to you for these last 45 minutes or so, really comes through. And I think there's lots that we can learn about this. As we're kind of coming to the close, we always ask our guests to give us maybe one idea, one kind of key area that they would highlight to act as a bit of a take-home message for all of us listening. What would you like us to all take away from tonight?
I suppose the final message about PBS really is that it's all about improving quality of life for people. Happy people whose lives are going well, who are well supported and their needs are being met, rarely show behaviours of concern. And one of the overall outcomes, hoped for outcomes when we're doing PBS, is that we just improve quality of life for people. And one of the interventions that we may put in, actually, before we do any WYSI functional assessments and we assess the environment, just think, actually, are there some simple ways that we can improve the quality of life of this person? Because sometimes just doing that alone means that the behaviours that we previously saw, we see far, far less of. So quality of life, happiness, well-being, if we can support the people we're working with to achieve those, then the likelihood is that the need for behaviours of concern will reduce dramatically in the first instance.
So,
anyway.
Thank you, Jane, so much. As Helen said, I think we've all thoroughly enjoyed listening to you. Thank you so much for your time. And thank you to everybody for listening.
Yep, we always appreciate your comments, your feedback. Get in touch with us through Twitter or Instagram, and Jane will be giving us some pointers and some information to pass on to you and to get in touch for more information. Thank you so much, Jane. That's been really interesting.